Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowans who love professional sports cheer for teams from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Missouri, and a random collection of places that we don't share borders with. We don't have any major professional sports teams, but for one season, Waterloo, Iowa was home to a National Basketball Association team, the Waterloo Hawks. Sports broadcaster Tim Harwood has written about the history of this team in his book, Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa, and he is with me now. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Charity.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I know I want to talk a little bit about your personal history. Back in 2005, you moved to Iowa. You moved to the Waterloo area to cover baseball, local baseball. And of course, now you're the voice of the Waterloo Blackhawks hockey team. Tell me when you first started getting interested in the history of sports in the Waterloo area.
Well, it was at that time when I moved to the Cedar Valley, having the chance to find out about the long baseball history in Waterloo, which dates back to the start of the 20th or even maybe the late 19th century. It was evident that sports ran pretty deep in Waterloo. And the Waterloo Blackhawks, you mentioned I still work for the Blackhawks after what's a long time in the sports broadcasting world. They've been around a long time, too, longer than many people might expect if they're not from Northeast Iowa. The Blackhawks have been here for nearly 60 years, going on 60 years, just a couple of seasons from now. So there are some pretty deep roots, and I'd actually worked for a couple of years in Central Iowa out in Jefferson, and I got the chance to cover high school sports there, but one day, watching the wires, there was this story about a new minor league basketball team coming to Waterloo, and part of the hook for the story was that Waterloo had once hosted an NBA team, and that's one of those things that you don't expect to encounter, and it stuck with me. So when I got the chance to actually be in Waterloo, it was something I had to look into once I had a little bit of time and had some background on the community.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and I had never heard that there was an NBA team in Waterloo, so it's not a part of history that seems to be common knowledge. When you started looking into it, how difficult was it to find information about it?
Well, if you knew where to look and there were only limited sources available, I think that there was quite a lot of information. You just had to know what those sources were likely to be. And I was fortunate. One of the reasons I felt I could take on this project was because that I'd done a lot of research into hockey history in Waterloo over the course of time working with the Blackhawks and having questions that there weren't answers to readily available about hockey. I'd spent a lot of time looking at microfilm, going through old articles and old archives of the Courier. And with that background, knowing what the microfilm looked like, knowing how the paper had been laid out historically over time, and how they covered sports, and a lot of credit for whatever is in this book should go to the writers from the Waterloo Courier from that era, the late 40s and early 1950s, because in an era where there was no internet, where there wasn't television yet, they were the way to follow along with sports in Waterloo if you weren't going to be at the games yourself.
Well, let's talk about what Waterloo was like during that time in the mid to late 1940s. What was the city like?
You know, it was diverse then as it is now. And part of that is because it's always been a very industrial town, going back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So whether we're talking about diversity with African-American populations moving from the South, whether we're talking about European immigrants coming across to work on the railroad or work in any of Waterloo's factories, it's always been a very diverse place. And that was certainly true in the late 1940s and early 1950s in the post-war era. It's always been a community that's had an industrial presence, And whether that's John Deere, whether that's Rath Packing, which hasn't been here for a couple of decades now, there have been things that attracted workers and allowed people to make a better life for themselves from wherever they'd come from. But also with all these different groups of people, I think that's one of the reasons why sports has been so impactful in Waterloo over time. Because it was an identity that everyone could adopt, whatever the team is, whether we're talking about the Waterloo Hawks baseball teams from all the decades that they played, even Waterloo football. There was a semi-professional football in town in the late 40s and into the 1950s. So if there was a sporting event that was going on in the community, it was probably bringing people out and helping to foster that sense that we're all on the same team on some level.
Well, you mentioned the diversity of Waterloo, which is something that the city is well known for. But when we look at the Waterloo Hawks, there were only white athletes on the court. Was sports something that brought a diverse crowd together when they weren't integrated?
You know, I've asked that question from people who went to sporting events in the era. And the reaction has been that generally baseball games, if we're talking about post-war era Waterloo, might have had a little bit more of a colorful fan base because there were integrated baseball teams coming through Waterloo. But at the same time, I've also heard that there were African-American fans. The circumstances of that era in post-war sports, it was a very transitional time. But at the same time, it was an interesting period because even though the Waterloo Hawks were an entirely white team, they did play some black teams. They played a sort of a generic version of the Harlem Globetrotters, a team that took part of the Globetrotter name, probably wouldn't be in the purest sense legal to do today, but nobody called them on it. And they toured around the state of Iowa in the fall of 1948 for a week. And so there were, it's not a really straightforward circumstance that you had there. And I think it was a time of change that isn't necessarily as you know, not to use the phrase glibly, but black and white.
Let's talk about basketball in that period of time. Of course, we know Iowa has always had, once basketball became a thing, we've always had enthusiastic high school basketball fans. But what was the state of the game in the mid-40s?
Well, certainly evolutionary at that point, too. The game was really changing dramatically. You'd go from a situation where you had players like Murray Weir, who was from Eastern Iowa, just outside of Muscatine, ended up playing at Muscatine High School. And the stories about him were that they cobbled together basketball gear when he was a kid. I think that they took the rim of a wheel and they made their own basketball and they played out near the barn on a dirt floor. And so the game was evolving from those roots. At that point, if we're talking about Murray Weir in his youth, he was only 30 years or so removed from the founding of the game by James Naismith in the 1890s. So you've got a lot more growth in the game in this period than you did in, say, baseball, where a lot of the rules and conventions had been well established. There were still, in professional basketball, questions about what the right length of a game should be. Should it be 40 minutes like the college game? Should it be 48 minutes as the NBA does have now? There were questions about what the foul implementation should be, foul counts on teams, and whether that should lead to free throws or who gets the ball after a foul. A lot of things were still up in the air that we sort of take for granted if we watch a basketball game today. And that's another thing that's interesting about looking at sports in the past, whether it's the recent past or the more distant past, you notice some little nuances. And one of the tricky things is everybody in 1948 or 49 or 50 knew what the rules of basketball were at the time, so they may not have made it as clear as what we would like looking back on it now. You've got to dig a little bit deeper to find out what the playing rules actually were and how they vary from today's game.
Now, you mentioned the state of professional basketball at the time. The NBA was not the first try at professional basketball. So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, the whole idea of having professional basketball was something that people were trying to get going for a while.
Yeah, it had been done over and over again. The first professional games were played in the 19-teens, and then the first leagues formed in the 1920s. The Great Depression, not surprisingly, was a big setback for professional basketball. There was a league that was forming in the 20s that didn't make it, that used the name National Basketball League, and there'd be another National Basketball League later, and that factors into the story of the Waterloo Hawks, but we'll get to that later on. But the teams in the big cities in the East, teams in Chicago, all the places that you would expect, and it really had a stumbling block in the Great Depression. I think baseball was able to go on because baseball teams were well established. It looked like hockey in the 1920s would become a really big sport, but it was limited by the Depression to the areas like Boston, New York, Detroit, and Chicago, and of course the Canadian cities that have NHL teams, Toronto, Montreal, those places, because there just wasn't a way to expand when times were so hard.
Right, making ice is expensive.
You know, but the crazy thing is they had pro hockey teams in places like Texas back in the 1920s, briefly, and so the Depression really altered the course of sports dramatically.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break, Tim, and then we'll talk more about the emergence of basketball as a professional sport and how it wound up in Waterloo, Iowa, and why we don't have a professional team in Waterloo, Iowa today. I'm talking with sports broadcaster Tim Harwood. He's written about the history of the Waterloo Hawks in his book, Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. You're listening to Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about professional basketball in Iowa. And you did not hear me wrong. The Waterloo Hawks was an NBA team for the very first season that the NBA was a league. And Tim Harwood has written about the history of this team. The book he's written is Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. And Tim, just before the break, we were talking about sort of the emergence of professional sports all over the United States. We were talking about hockey and how the NHL grew. All right, so basketball. There were several tries before the NBA became a thing. It seems to me like it would be a lot easier to have professional basketball teams than to have a professional hockey team. It's just a lot lower maintenance, but hockey took off a lot faster, didn't it?
Well, for a time, but basketball came around in the mid-1930s. There was a league calling itself the Midwest Conference. They changed their name to the National Basketball League in 1937. They were the latest league to use that name. It's a very prominent-sounding name. It sounds impressive. And they were arguably the most successful up until that point because they continued to play on through the war, through World War II, despite it at one point, I think, being down to three teams. They managed to find a way to keep basketball going on the professional level. And then when the war ended, when players were returning home after putting aside their athletic careers to serve, there was an influx of talent, but also a big opportunity there, because not only did the National Basketball League have a growing roster of teams, But also a new league was formed in the East, the Basketball Association of America. And National Basketball League, again, from its origin as the Midwest Conference, was very Midwest-centric, focused on Illinois, Indiana, into Wisconsin and Ohio. The Basketball Association of America was much more like the picture you might have of Major League Baseball at the time. New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, and also stretching as far west as Chicago and St. Louis.
Now, let's talk about Waterloo, because even then it doesn't seem, when you're talking about, you know, teams in Chicago and Boston and New York and St. Louis, Waterloo doesn't seem like it would be on the radar. How did Waterloo get on the radar?
Waterloo benefited from the interaction between the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America. Again, the NBL with teams in places like Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and other smaller communities, Moline, and they called them the Tri-Cities. We'd, of course, call them the Quad Cities now. But the National Basketball League had to try to stay afloat. It was very much like some of the conference rating that's going on in college sports over these last couple of decades, because in the winter of 1947-48, there was a third league that tried to form, the Professional Basketball League of America, just to really muddle things up. And that was an opportunity for the Basketball Association of America to capitalize on some friction that was happening in the NBL. The next season, they swiped wholesale four whole teams, got them to switch from one league to the other. The Minneapolis Lakers, the most notable of them, and the Lakers, of course, still playing today in Los Angeles. It's the same Lakers organization. But with these four teams suddenly taken out of the National Basketball League, to have a viable circuit, you had to put a team in any place that you could find that was viable. And Waterloo had a terrific venue. The National Cattle Congress has been held in Waterloo since the early 19-teens, and the Hippodrome, which has just retaken that name in Waterloo over the last couple of months, was a venue that could hold about 8,000 people. All you needed was a basketball floor, and by some fortunate circumstances, there was a court that was ready to go there. And with an owner that was open-minded about the potential for Waterloo and the sports fans that were in the community, it was where a team landed, along with Calumet and Denver, Colorado, just to kind of make sure the league could continue on and remain competitive with their arch rivals from the big cities.
And of course, I mean, we're focusing on the fact that it was an NBA team. Before it was an NBA team, as you've been telling us, it was a PBLA team. So let's talk about when the Waterloo Hawks first started playing. Where were they drawing their talent from? Were they local men playing basketball?
You know, for the most part, they were from other places. There were a few exceptions to that. And there was always a pull to try to bring in somebody local. I mentioned Murray Weir earlier in the program. He was playing for the Tri-Cities Blackhawks in Moline, and he was a great attraction because he'd been such a huge star at the University of Iowa in the post-war years. And even though he wasn't playing a lot for Tri-Cities, he was a player who could draw a crowd just by his name because of the tremendous success he had with Iowa. So the Hawks tried to do something similar with a few different players. Jack Spencer was one. He was another University of Iowa guard. And Noble Jorgensen was a center who played just briefly in Waterloo during the I guess you could call it a season in the PBLA, because that league disintegrated almost before it began. So, yeah, there was some motivation to bring in players with regional or local ties. But for the most part, you were getting players that you would expect to be playing top-level professional basketball. For the most part, you were getting players that were stars, All-Americans in some cases, with their college teams. The National Basketball League season, the big players were Harry Boykoff, literally, who was 6'10 or 6'11 from St. John's and had set the Madison Square Garden scoring record, and Dick Meehan from the University of Tennessee, who'd been, at least on one list, an All-American there. So you were getting those top-level players.
So they had the facilities, they had the players. How did they get the audience? What was the strategy to try to draw people in?
I don't think it was a tough sell. I think that with the ability to claim that you had major league professional sports, that was a big step in the right direction. They got some tremendous help from the Waterloo Courier. The Courier played up the fact this was big league sports. And the other thing about the time period, again, this is before television. This is when radio is covering baseball, but college football, not a lot of other sports. If you wanted to be a sports fan, you had to go and attend. And Waterloo was a place where people did. In 1947, the Waterloo Hawks baseball team, including their playoff run to a championship in the league that they were in, drew over 200,000 fans. So that's a pretty good feel for the ability to draw a crowd of several thousand on any given night. And it certainly carried through to basketball, even in bad weather.
Well, that said, it was still hard for them to get enough people in the door to make enough money to have a profitable team, right?
And that was true for just about every professional basketball team of the era. The dollars were tough to come up with, especially while the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association were battling for one pool of players. You might be drafted by one team in one league and another team in the other league, and then you could play the two against each other. And it was really a situation where the players had a different sort of leverage than they did in professional sports throughout history at that time, unless there was a rival league where you could get teams to duel with each other and bid up the other. The way that contracts were structured were set up in such a way that a player had to stick with the team that they were on year after year after year until that team was ready to get rid of him. So there was some motivation there for the National Basketball League, the Basketball Association of America, to come together. That helped to lead to the merger that happened in 1949-50, because just like any other business, personnel was a major cost.
I'm talking with Tim Harwood. His book is Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. And while the Waterloo Hawks only had a brief tenure in Waterloo, if you remember watching the games, if you remember this time, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tell us your story, share some of your memories, 866-780-9100. So, all right, that season before the NBA formed, how did the Waterloo Hawks perform?
They were just a little below 500. They were competitive. They got off to a tremendous start. I think they won 9 out of their first 10 games off the top of my head. But they really struggled on the road. And in some ways, that was a product of the challenges of traveling at that time, which even though the distances were shorter, you weren't going from Los Angeles to New York the way that NBA teams do today.
Right, but it still took you longer than it would to get from Los Angeles to New York.
Well, and can you imagine an NBA team going anywhere by car?
No.
And this is what the players were doing, in some cases literally by car, not even on a bus. And so you're cramped. You've got NBA basketball players, so they're 6'7", 6'8", big guys crouched in a car. And or on a train, which wasn't that much more comfortable. The trips were just as long, if not longer, in terms of time. And so winning on the road was really a challenge. There also may have been some hometown officiating, because all teams in the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America really seemed to do a little bit better on their home court when you look at the numbers from that era. So they struggled on the road. They just missed the playoffs in the 1948-49 season when they were part of the National Basketball League. But they finished just outside, and it was an odd circumstance. There were 9 teams in the league, 4 in one division, 5 in the other. The Hawks were in the team with in the division with 5 teams, and had they been in the other division, they would have been a playoff team with the record that they had. So There was a sense that they were right there on the cusp, and that if circumstances had just been a little bit different, that they would have been a more successful team on the court, and they were reasonably successful off the court. We talked about dollars and cents earlier. They didn't make a profit in their first season, but they weren't too far off. They lost less than other teams, which is something, I guess, that is better than it could have been.
Right. Okay. So now where was the kernel for the NBA? Where did that come from? Because, again, you've mentioned all these other leagues that have been struggling and competing. Where does the idea for the NBA come from, and why does it seem to be stronger than those other ideas?
Well, there was a big moment in the summer of 1949 when the National Basketball League convinced the group of players that was most sought after to all come to their league together and form the Indianapolis Olympians. That team was made up of players primarily from the University of Kentucky, and they're called the Olympians because they had represented the U.S. in 1948 in the Olympic Games. Altogether, they won the gold. They dominated in many ways in that Olympic tournament. And the Basketball Association of America, those teams out in the East, the Knicks, the Celtics, the Warriors, and Philadelphia, they were going to divide them up, as you would expect, with a draft, and they were going to go different places. They're going to help out the teams that had struggled and had the highest draft picks, not much different than what we have today. The National Basketball League said, we need to get these guys. We're not going to get them by drafting them and trying to convince them that they need to go to Sheboygan or Oshkosh or someplace that they've never been. We'll get them to play together. We'll get them to go to Indianapolis and form a team there and compete against the Basketball Association of America team in that market. They're the ones with the names and the star power. They're going to win. And it was something that brought the Basketball Association of America to the bargaining table. They said, if you guys are going to get this team as one whole unit, we want to find a way to bring them in. It's too good an opportunity to miss. Plus, there was that pressure I already had mentioned with salaries, with bidding for players. There was some push to get together and talk about it and see whether a merger was a possibility. And ultimately, that's what the two leagues did. That's how you get the NBA from the NBL and the BAA. It's a shuffling of acronyms as much as it is of everything else.
I want to go to the phones again. If you have memories of the Waterloo Hawks, we'd love to hear about them. 866-780-9100. John is on the line in Waterloo. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you?
Good. And this is something you remember, right?
I do. I was pretty small at the time, but I did see one or two games. I can remember that. But what I called about was Johnny Orr played for the Waterloo Hawks at one time, too.
Johnny Orr, who, of course, had a storied career as the coach at Iowa State University. Did you get to see Johnny Orr play, or do you know?
I can't remember. I couldn't have been over 8 years old or so at the time. But so I can't remember, but I can remember from the history that him and Murray Weir, you know, were the two that I remember most, I guess. And I know there were probably bigger stars than that, but they're the ones I remember.
Oh, wow. And do you remember when they folded? Was there a sadness? You were pretty young.
Yes, I was, but I've heard stories, and maybe your guest there probably bring that out, but Red Auerbach from Boston hated to come to Waterloo. The locker rooms weren't what they should have been, I guess, according to NBA standards or whatever, and he lobbied to get him out of the league as far as that goes, I guess.
Yeah, so, we will definitely talk about that. But John, thanks so much for calling.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thanks for the program.
Yeah. So Johnny Orr, of course, one of our basketball favorites in Iowa, played for the Waterloo Hawks. Tim?
Yeah, he was part of the NBA season. He'd started that year with the St. Louis Bombers, and they had not really found a way to use him in a way that was giving him much time on the court. They decided to ship him up to Waterloo. It was probably January or February of 1950, and he finished out the year with the Hawks, and actually he was a University of Illinois player before he went to Beloit College to finish his NCAA career, and there are a lot of connections between Waterloo and the University of Illinois on those teams.
Now, there were no other Iowa teams that were in the NBA, but there was a near neighbor in Illinois. Tell me about the Tri-City Blackhawks.
They had been established a few years earlier, an organization that had moved there from Buffalo after things had not been working out in Western New York, and they were the model in a lot of ways for what people hoped to accomplish in Waterloo, because like the Hawks, their first season had been iffy when it comes to the business standpoint, but they'd really gained a following. They played at Wharton Fieldhouse, and their attendance grew, and they were one of the more profitable teams by the time the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America merged. They had some stars, and I think they had one of the better followings of the smaller market cities in professional basketball at that time. And eventually they had a coach who would become as synonymous with professional basketball as any name you can imagine from the 20th century.
Yeah, and reveal for us here.
That would be Red Auerbach, who went on to win seemingly every time his teams took the court in Boston with the Celtics. But before that, he'd actually been a coach in the Basketball Association of America with the Washington Capitals for 3 years. He'd been very successful there. Still a really young man when he came to Moline at just 29.
We're talking about the Waterloo Hawks, Waterloo, Iowa's professional basketball team. They were only in part of the NBA for that first season in 1949. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. I'm talking with sports broadcaster and writer Tim Harwood. His book is Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about professional basketball in Waterloo. Tim Harwood is my guest. He's written the book Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. And we're talking about the Waterloo Hawks, which were part of the NBA back in 1949, the 1949-1950 season. You are welcome to join the conversation. Do you have memories of the Waterloo Hawks? We'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Tim, I would love for you to read a passage from the book for us. You were talking earlier about how even the rules of basketball were really in flux at this time. And I mean, they were really, really in flux at this time, and they continued to change over the next few seasons after Waterloo exited the NBA. But I'd love for you to read a passage for us that gives us a sense of that.
We've been talking about the NBL and the Basketball Association of America merging to form the NBA, and this is what they went into that merger with. At the time of the merger, when professional players could still remember learning the sport using a ball stitched with football-like laces, basketball was still in the midst of major refinements. The game's history had included an era when a single designated shooter took all of his team's free throws, when there was no three-second lane violation, and when teams made their way to midcourt after each field goal to restart play with a jump ball. By the late 1940s, all of these customs had been swept away. Other rules like goaltending, which had been implemented in response to the emergence of bigger centers like George Mikan and Harry Boykoff, and amateur athletic union sensation Bob Kierlin, had been in effect for only a few years. One observer shared his impressions of professional basketball during the era after seeing an exhibition during the post-war period. Fans who were accustomed to the collegiate and high school variety of basketball watched with awe as the pros demonstrated some deft ball handling and floor play. They saw, too, a brand of basketball that incorporated all the major features of football. The rugged style is more or less typical of the professional habits in the sport. More changes were still in the future. In 1951, the NBA would double the width of the lane from 6 to 12 feet. That forced large-bodied centers to be more active under the basket in order to avoid a three-second call. Jump shots would gradually supplant set shots as the preferred shooting method from a long distance. The underhanded free-throw technique would eventually be replaced by the overhead style. The three-point line was a distant innovation, still more than a generation away.
Fascinating. That's Tim Harwood reading from his book, Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. And as unlikely as it seems that there was a professional basketball team in Waterloo, I mean, they were in the same league with the Boston Celtics, with the New York Knicks. What was that dynamic like with these teams coming to Waterloo from these really big cities?
Well, it was a different circumstance, and I think that it'd be fair to say that a lot of those large city players and their staff that came with them had a sense that they didn't want to be traveling to places like Waterloo and to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Let me share another passage. This is actually the writing of Waterloo Courier sports editor Al Nye, and he was writing this right on the eve of the first game of the season, 1949-50, first year of the NBA, with Waterloo about to play the New York Knicks in the season opener. And this is what he had to say. It's no secret that the larger cities expect Waterloo to fold after this year. Directors of the club here refuse to work on that basis. In fact, they have long-range plans for pro ball here, but could suffer a severe setback if fans don't welcome the sport with open arms and pocketbooks. Crowds will have to average about 4,000 per game here to pay the bills. Waterloo could easily wind up better off financially than four or five other clubs in the 17-team league, but the big cities have strictly the show us attitude now. I think that pretty well sums up the feelings of the larger markets when it came to the smaller ones.
Well, and we'll talk about at least one really incredible victory for Waterloo in just a second, but I want to get to the phones. John is on the line in Waverly. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, and you actually had a chance to play against the Waterloo Hawks? Tell me about this.
I sure did. It was 1949. I was a freshman at Wartburg College, and it was the first game to be played in the brand-new Knights Gymnasium. And we played an exhibition game against the Waterloo Hawks. I remember jumping center. At that time, Dick Meehan was playing. And I've lost the program from that night. I've been looking for it to find out who all the other players were at that time in 1949. And one of the other things we noticed, they also dressed in our locker room with us. And I noticed Dick Meehan had six toes.
Oh. All right. Well, that doesn't show up in the book, Tim.
That's something you can put in the book.
Right. Oh, fascinating. Did you ever go watch the Waterloo Hawks on their home court?
We certainly did. We lived in, at that time, I lived in Denver, Iowa, and we were regulars watching them. In fact, I have a program from the night they played the New York Knickerbockers. So,
wow.
You know,
well, that's
quite an attraction.
Right. Well, John, thank you so much for sharing your memories. And the Hawks did play a lot of exhibition games around the state. So they would, you know, playing up at Wartburg College was just one of the kind of things that they would have done, right?
Right around Thanksgiving in 1949, in fact. Yeah. And it's funny that that John brings that up, because there is actually not of his six toes, but there is a mention of Dick Meehan's toe. And this, again, goes to something Al Nye said. And one aspect of the Hawks that we haven't had a chance to touch on: in their NBA season, they were owned by members of the community. There were nearly 400 different shareholders who had a fraction of the team. And one of the things that, this is credit to Courier sports editor Al Nye from that era, talking about the way that people might approach their ownership, owning just a small fraction of the team. He said, quote, they'll probably be figuring out just what each owns. For $10, for instance, a guy might figure he owns Dick Meehan's big toe. So there is a reference to Dick Meehan's toes in the book, but not having six of them.
All right. Well, let's talk about that in investor model, because as I mentioned, I mean, the Waterloo Hawks were struggling financially after their first season before the NBA became the NBA. And so that was an idea. Okay, we'll ask local people to invest in the team. And they wound up with 377 individual investors.
The original owner of the team had been Pinky George, who was a promoter, a wrestling promoter, a boxing promoter. He was living in Des Moines, but he was originally from Cedar Falls. And about halfway through the NBL season, the 48-49 year, he decided it just wasn't something he could devote time to. There was a claim that it was a health issue that was leading him to step away. He lived to be well into his 80s, so I don't think it was anything that was too serious from a health standpoint. But he stepped away. His brother and the player coach of the team, Charlie Shipp, took over ownership for the rest of that year. They weren't men of tremendous means, and with the team losing around $15,000 that first year, they knew that they couldn't keep the team going. So there were people who wanted to. There were people who had important roles at community institutions, at banks, at John Deere, at Rath Packing, at just about any sort of sizable organization or entity in the community. And they said, we want to keep professional basketball in Waterloo. We think this is good for the community. We feel like we're not far away from having a really good thing here. And so they had a stock drive in the summer of 1949 and said, we want to raise $30,000. That'll pay off the debt and get us the team. It'll get us started for the next year. If we can do that, we'll keep basketball that way with community ownership. And they raised around $36,000 or so.
I want to talk about one of the real highlights of that one season in the NBA for the Waterloo Hawks. And that was one of their, I mean, they played teams repeatedly because there weren't that many teams in the league. But one of their matchups with the Celtics, that was just a huge victory for the Hawks. Tell me about that game.
Well, the Celtics were the first victory of the 1949-50 season. Boston came to Waterloo just a couple of days after the Knicks had been in town. So you have what would turn out to be in the decades that followed. You get basketball royalty in Waterloo separated by about 48 hours. And the Hawks made the most of it. The Celtics were not the Celtics then that they would come to be. And Waterloo came out on top with a pretty big victory.
Right, 80-66.
Yeah, a 14-point win against the Boston Celtics. Again, this is when Red Auerbach isn't quite there yet. Bill Russell hasn't landed in Boston.
We're just counting it. It's an extraordinary victory.
You know, there were a couple of other really notable wins that we talked earlier about the Indianapolis Olympians who had represented the U.S. at the Olympics in 1948. They'd won national championships when they were members of the Kentucky Wildcats. Christmas Day in 1949, I almost call them Wildcats because that's really what they were. The Olympians were in Waterloo. They were leading by 12 points with under a minute to go, but they were sort of a travel-weary team. They were dealing with some injuries. They had a short bench. They coughed up the 12-point lead in the last minute, and the Hawks went on to win it in overtime. And it was a huge crowd that was there on hand for the game. And as you'd expect, your team's down by 12. This is before the three-point line, so it's not easy to get back into a game like this. There were people headed for the exits, getting out into their cars. It's a cold night in Waterloo, and they came streaming back into the building. They had to open essentially a garage door-sized door to let all the people back into the game that were trying to get back in to see the overtime.
Trapping in the snow.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Well, okay. There was this huge local following. There were almost 400 local investors. There were a lot of people who believed in the Waterloo Hawks, but the NBA itself didn't believe in the Waterloo Hawks. How did they get kicked out of the league?
Well, there was a proposal at one point in February to try to cut the league into a couple of different pieces. They'd have a major league with all the big cities, and they'd have a minor league, and that wasn't going to fly with Waterloo. And a place like Sheboygan, I've mentioned a couple of times, Sheboygan had had professional basketball for a decade at this point. They'd been very successful, and they really weren't going to settle for being shoved off into some minor league. The season came to an end, and there were a couple of efforts to find things that would be hurdles that places like Waterloo and Sheboygan couldn't overcome. They wanted to have each team come up with a $50,000 performance guarantee. If they couldn't finish the season, someone from the community was going to have to pay $50,000 as a fee for not performing. And Waterloo Sheboygan said, yeah, we can deal with that. We'll find a way to make that happen. So finally, they got to April of 1950. They're having a league meeting in Chicago. They're having the draft all at the same time. And they're starting to work out the details for the following season. And they simply voted not to put Waterloo and Sheboygan and Denver, because they were way out in the mountains and too far to get too easily, just not to put them on the schedule for that next season. And that's how Waterloo's time in the NBA came to an end. There was quite a bit of bitterness, as you might expect, and so the teams that had been shoved out went and formed their own league and were trying to get some others involved, and they played through most of the next season, but it was tough to compete, and there was a sense, I think, from some people that this no longer, now that we had this opportunity to be in a league with Boston and New York and Philadelphia, this isn't the same thing that next year.
Right. They played their final game in March of 1951. What do you think we can learn from this story of the Waterloo Hawks? What do you think the legacy is in Iowa of this team?
You know, I think it shows a lot of determination. The folks in Waterloo, the shareholders that we talked about, the fans, they were determined that they were going to play on as long as they possibly could. And they were going to take on the big cities. If those were the opponents that were on the schedule, they were going to play. And in some cases, they were going to win. I think one of the real takeaways that I've had from this, though, you know, you talked about growing up in Cedar Falls and not knowing this story. And I think that in that era, in the 1950s and onward, maybe even still today, there was the sense that in this instance, Waterloo had lost out on something. They had this great opportunity. They'd lost it through no fault of their own, but they'd lost this effort to keep professional basketball at this high level here. And as a result, one of the reasons I don't think you ever heard this story is because people didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to reflect on that thing that they'd lost. And so the takeaway for me is to, as even if it's painful at times, is to be proud of the things that we've accomplished and the things that we've overcome. And even if they don't end up working out well, it's still a great story when it's all said and done.
It certainly is. And we, of course, you know, we're a state with, we don't have a lot of big cities. We don't really have any really big cities by professional sports league standards. So we're probably not ever going to have a major professional sports team. Although we do have, of course, minor league teams that have big followings here in the state of Iowa. As somebody who works in sports in Iowa, what do you think about our sporting culture in the state? What do you like about it? What makes it special?
Oh, I think it's great. I think that there's so much enthusiasm because one of the upsides of sports beyond the big league level is that you can really get close to the players, you can get close to the organization and feel like it really is your team, more so than the guy who's sitting in the 50th row who's paid $50 to get those seats and probably $30 for the T-shirt he's wearing. You know, it's not like that here. You can get much closer. You can, in most cases, if we're talking about Midwest League baseball or United States Hockey League hockey or the Cedar Valley Court Kings of the Midwest Basketball League that are in Waterloo today, you can get a lot closer to those organizations, even the college teams. In a lot of ways, there are pathways to be involved that you just don't have if you're talking about the Chicago Bulls or, you know, the Minnesota Twins or pick your major league sport in your mega metropolis.
And I know the Court Kings have struggled to build their following. Do you think they're going to stick around? You see a successful future for minor league basketball in Iowa?
I think so. You know, Gary Rima, the play-by-play announcer for the UNI Panthers, is the owner of the Court Kings. He really has a vision for that organization. As much as a business, I think he wants it to be a place where players can develop and create opportunities for themselves, whether they're coming out of a place like UNI or another smaller school. And so that's his motivation, as much as a business, is to create opportunity.
Well, Tim Harwood, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
The book is Ball Hawks, The Arrival and Departure of the NBA in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.